The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a Swangled
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, and .video, vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate the support. You can follow us on Twitter at Macroaggression, or you can go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Big thank you to our sponsors that make the show happen. EMP Shield is building the best EMP and lightning shielding device out there. It works on homes, cars, motorhomes, boats, generators. You can get bundle packages, whatever you need. It'll prevent EMPs, solar flares, lightning strikes, all kinds of things that may impact you. It's many times more efficient than a normal single-use military design. It can withstand up to 40 strikes. So you can buy it over at empshield.com. You can install it yourself. There's installation videos there, or you can hire an electrician to come out. It's fitted to a household circuit breaker with just four wires and installs like a type 2 surge protector. So if you're interested, you're in the market for something like this, go to empshield.com. Take a look around. See what you think. If you find something you like, use the promo code MACRO on your way out. And also, big thanks to Legal Shield. This might be appropriate for this episode. The website that they built for us is don'tgetpushedaround.com. Listen, this company's been in business for half a century in Canada and the United States. It's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards high-powered law firms in your area so that you get access to an attorney with, on average, 22 years of experience that can help you with all kinds of things. Knock out all that paperwork for you. You need a last will and testament, a financial power of attorney, a medical directive, any of that stuff you can get taken care of with Legal Shield right now. It's $30 a month. It's $1 a day. It's incredibly reasonable. So I'll tell you what, if it's something that you think might be interested to you, just go to the website. www.don'tgetpushedaround.com is the place to be. Well, I need to thank one of my listeners, Nancy, in upstate New York, who said, I read this book. I've got a book for you. I'd like to send it to you. And she did. And she said, I think it might be up your alley. And it was. And so it's my pleasure to have the author of the book Pressure with me, a memoir by Eric Kanori. Eric Kanori, nice to meet you, Eric. How are you?
I'm great, Charlie. Thank you for having me on, and thank you, Nancy.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy, for setting this up. This is a tremendous book about, well, you know, you think you know what it's about. You think you know what it's about. You think you know that it's about somebody that got on the wrong side of the law. But really, it's a much deeper book. At least that's how I took it. It's a book about your feelings and about being accepted and about growing up in a household in which you're constantly looking for approval and what that does to somebody. And it's, boy, I'll tell you, I'll never look at Chipotle the same way after reading this. the $1 million Chipotle lunch sounded like an option to you at one point. Where do we even start with this? Like, how do you go about describing your life? Because your life, at least phase one of it, was pretty wild. And it seems like you're now transitioning into something else. But how do we get started on this?
I know where we start. You tell them the couple highlights to hook them so they stick around, and then we'll rock and start.
You sold $300 million worth of weed. Let's start with that.
I did well over $300 million worth of cannabis sales in the U.S. before it was legal in any single state in the United States. I smuggled it over the out of Canada via 18-wheelers, boats, snowmobiles, helicopters, you name it. We did it. Had accounts in every single state of the East Coast between New Orleans and Boston. Operated with burner phones, PGP encrypted BlackBerries. With our own servers. What did I do? Oh, eventually I got caught up with the law, though, in 2009, and they wanted me to work undercover. Caught me in the wrong place, the wrong time. I wouldn't do it. Put me in jail. Fought it. Preparing for trial for a couple years, and eventually my lawyer came to me in a jail cell. He's like, hey, listen, you give them the rest of your money, they'll let you go. And that's, I mulled it over for a few weeks, and that's when I went out into the woods in shackles, and I unearthed close to $10 million in gold bars I buried over the years, gave them to federal agents, and then they let me out. I still did some time, but yeah, I guess that's the end of the story almost, but we can start at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, you can know what the ending of this story is going to be and still want to buy this book and still need to read this book, because it's no secret. There's gold on the cover. You know, you read the intro, you know what it's about. You know, it's about this, but the road that led you there, I found really interesting, because as a kid, you talk about, you're very open in this book. It must have been extremely cathartic to write it. You talk about growing up and feeling like never enough to please your mother, and this drive to want to kind of get out of the house and prove to the world that you can do it. You can be something. You can be somebody. You can be somebody that's respected and looked up to, and somebody that's successful, and you can do all these things. And you can do all those things. And you did do all those things. But it just happened to be something that the federal government considers to be illegal. Moving a plant from one place to another seems pretty stupid to me. I'm somebody that speaks at anarchist conferences, for fuck's sake. I mean, obviously, I have no love for the government. And I'm not somebody that thinks that this sort of thing should be illegal. But it is, and it was at the time. And as somebody that lives in Colorado, which probably will trigger you, considering you were sitting in a jail cell while Colorado gets legal, you know, what did this entire decade of being under pressure teach you about yourself?
Wow, that's a big question to start with. But the entire decade of prior to my arrest or after the arrest?
Prior to your arrest, because you were on a run there pretty good where nobody was messing with you, and you were building and building and building, and you didn't ever, at least according to the book, didn't ever feel like you were even close to getting busted, because you were so organized and so methodical, and you did the things that nobody else wanted to do, and it seemed like this might be the time. Like, this might be the story that nobody ever hears about. The guy that does sell hundreds of millions of dollars of drugs and gets away with it, and nobody ever busts him. I honestly, the way you had this set up, it felt like you were untouchable.
Yeah, there was a time when I was untouchable. I was a ghost, and it's really the basic things. It's never talking to anybody. I didn't talk to my girlfriends about my business. I didn't even talk to my associates about my business. The only people that knew anything was it was a need to know basis. If I tell you to go here at 5 p.m. and pick up this box, all you know is that you're going to pick up a box at 5 p.m. You don't know I might have 10 other people picking up boxes that work for me. You know nothing. And that's how my life was, a need to know basis. The only problem was that it becomes lonely at times because nobody knows who you really are. I mean, they know who you want, the face or the mask that you put on, but let's just put it this way. Being off the grid and under the radar for that amount of time became lonely. Couldn't hold down a girlfriend, really couldn't start a family. I didn't want to have a family and end up leaving kids behind while I was in a jail. So I knew I'd eventually get pinched at some time. But I'll tell you one thing. It is nice not having to answer to authority, though. I lived outside the law, right? It's not like April 15th taxes are due. I just keep rocking and rolling, keep making the money, stacking it. And then maybe once a year, I'll do a tally on my net worth. Really, because I have money in all different places moving constantly at all different times. So what did I learn about? I learned a lot about people because I worked with people at the very top, white collar, with people at the bottom, you know, that might have dirt floors or lack of food in the refrigerator. So I worked with a wide variety of people. I've been in multiple different styles and types of homes from all different places, different ethnicities, different skin colors, doesn't matter. I worked with a wide variety of people, so I learned a lot about life. In the underworld, it's a lot different than in the corporate world or in the legal world. Being a law-abiding citizen is much different than living in the underworld. In the underworld, there are very few rules, and they're not enforced with attorneys. They're enforced with other rules and regulations that you may have seen some in the movies. And yeah, that's a big question, bro. You got to start with smaller ones.
Yeah, probably. but you talk about the like 50, I mean, like 15 burner phones would put me over the edge. You know what I mean? Like just that component of it where you've got multiple phones and they've got letters on them and you know which one this one means, you know, and you open up the
smart about it though. I was an efficiency expert. So all the burner phones use the same cell phone charger. So I only needed one cell phone charger for 15 phones. Right. Well, so that's efficient, except the Blackberries. I had like 3 or 4 Blackberries, which was unique. I said those were the PGP encrypted ones. We had our own servers. I didn't know how that was all set up. The tech, they did that stuff. But when they sent those Blackberries to DC to be during the investigation, they couldn't even open them.
Really?
Which was impressive. I was like, this stuff really works. Cause I was always like, does it really work? And I was like, nah, it does.
Wow. You had a system down for sure. You could write a book on organizational habits of the wealthy or something. I don't know, because it was, you had certain policies about things that you talked to people about, things that you didn't talk to them about, certain people. This person would go from this place to this place. This person would come from California and drive out, load them up. But it seemed like you had got yourself into a routine and a rhythm that worked for you and that you trusted. How do you manage that in a constantly changing environment where you're always looking over your shoulders?
I was really driven because I was in a position as a child where when you don't think you're going to make it, you'll do anything to survive, whether it's breaking the rules or working 100 hours a week, in which I did. I worked 100 hours a week because mostly out of fear, because I was in a position as a child where I didn't know where I was going to get food that night or if I had a safe place to sleep where I wouldn't be harmed, you know? So all my hustle and grind was out of fear for security and safety. It wasn't to bling out or be flashy or, you know, I did like spending money on women, though. I will say that's my one splurge. But, you know, I did, unfortunately, all my work out of fear of not having enough and being in a position where I didn't think I was going to make it. And then I did have enough, but I just kept going. I was like a robot on autopilot, make more, work harder. Every day I grinded, and there's sacrifices to that too, right? Because I didn't have a family. I wasn't able to have kids. couldn't settle down with a girlfriend, so I'd never be home or wasn't home on time. So that led me to the lonely life where a lot of times I would have to pay for high-end escorts when I'm in a random city just because I didn't have a girlfriend to talk to or see. So that became a habit. How'd I do it? All I did was work, showed up on time, under promise, over delivered, basic things like that, keeping your word and providing good vibes. You know, when you show up to deals with people you don't know, you're about ready to do a $1 million deal. Everything's about energy. You have to feel the vibe. You can't look at their resume or anything like that. So right. I learned a lot about street smarts. You know, I could write a book on how to be a successful drug dealer, but I don't condone that stuff. I don't promote it, but I do know I had a 99.99% success rate in the game. And I made one small little mistake and that put me under. And, you know, in the legitimate world, you have a mistake and then you sit back and reflect. You may have a bad quarter. You sit back and reflect how you can tighten things up, make it more efficient. You can't do that in this game. I'm out. Right. Yeah. Granted, I could go back to the game if I wanted, but I'm red flag for life. So I couldn't. And also, I'd probably only run for 10, 15 years and I'll get scooped up again with something else. So it's just not a way for me to live. I can make money elsewhere. I'm a pretty intelligent guy. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, it looks like some of the skills that you create great CEOs. You were using, you know, like you had great customer relation. You did what you when you said you were going to be there, you were there. If you under promised and over delivered, and you built a reputation for yourself as somebody that kept their mouth shut and didn't deal with, you know, and you weren't flashy. That's the thing that I could never understand about the guys that were in the drug game was that, you know, you're in a position where everybody's looking for somebody. Why are you making yourself a gigantic target, wearing big rings and jewelry and acting like an asshole and getting drunk and driving and doing all this? You didn't do any of that stuff. You drove like a nondescript pickup truck, right? The same type of truck. You didn't buy the big house. You had a legitimate business. You started a outdoor, like a pond, manufacturing business, doing all that stuff. You did everything right. Like you really, like it's kind of hard to read this book and go, oh, that's the bad guy in the scenario. You know, that's the bad drug dealer. You go, well, it didn't seem that bad in here. You were anti-violence the whole time, right? You never hurt anybody except yourself, maybe.
Yeah. Well, let me to answer your question is why do other drug dealers do that and blame and show off? One thing I noticed about a lot of drug dealers in the underworld, and this could be, I'm not here to stereotype, but I noticed that a lot of them seem to come from troubled childhoods or where they had nothing or they didn't have supportive family. They didn't have enough money to buy new shoes or cool toys. So once they get that money, they have a desire to prove to the world, you know what? I did make it. Because they were beat down as a kid. You know, when you come out of the womb and you're 7 years old and 6 years old and all the other kids around you have a new bike and you bought a used one at a garage sale that doesn't really work and like the tire keeps falling off, you know, like that is a feeling of insufficiency. And naturally, you're going to want to be validated in one way or another. You're going to want to be noticed and recognized by others for being successful, not being a loser. I felt like a loser when I didn't have the new sneakers or if I had vinyl sneakers instead of leather sneakers or if I didn't have cleats on my soccer shoes. I felt like a loser and I was embarrassed. And as I made money, there was a silent part of me that wanted to be recognized and noticed and seek validation and get a star or a trophy. Or something to say, good job, you did it. But I never could do that in the underworld. I couldn't be like, hey, I just surpassed 100 million this year. You know, you can't tell. I didn't tell anybody. I bought the same little truck. I did it. But at the end of the day, it's that primal instinct of all of us want to survive and thrive, right? When you're running around in the woods, you know, if you're the strongest and the best, there's probably the most fertile woman is going to come up to you and want to mate with you, right? Procreate and make stronger human beings, right? So it's that primal thing. But yeah, I didn't bling out, but I understand why the other guys do. I totally get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I did too. How did your view of money change over the years? Because it started, let's make some money. And then at some point, it wasn't about the money. You had all the money you would ever need. It was about something else. What was your relationship with money over time?
Well, physically, it got a point where we didn't even count it anymore. We weighed it.
That's like in Blow in the movie. Blow. He's like, just put it like on the scale. Bill.
Yeah, U.S. currency, a bill is 0.99 grams. So we could weigh our money. And then, but how did money change? Man, I had a lot of money. I'd forget where I placed it a lot of times. But the my view of money is, if you really don't have a good handle on it, it can rob you of your who you are as a person, man. I was unhealthy and hollow inside. Think about how many people you know that have tons of money coming out their ears and pockets, but they're unhealthy and cranky. Like the first step is to really be healthy with nothing. If you stand in front of a mirror and you look at yourself naked with nothing, are you happy with what you see? If you are happy with what you see there, then you can start adding the layers onto your life, the materialistic things, mm-hmm. right? Like, granted, we need the food and shelter, but then after that, you can start adding on things. Maybe you put on a watch, or maybe you put on a newer shirt or a nicer shirt and all these things. And then maybe you'll even fertilize your lawn so it looks green. So somebody will say to you, good job. Your lawn looks beautiful today. That's going to make you feel good, right? You're going to be like, oh shit, they noticed my lawn. Damn.
Moving up in the world.
Yeah, fuck yeah, dog. So listen, you know, but I've gotten over that. Like, we were programmed as children between ages 1 and 7 is when you are programmed the most in your entire life. Like 90% of who we are as adults was programmed between ages 1 and 7, right? So we're programmed to go out, win, accomplish, be somebody in the world. And the way you show off your accomplishments and being some in the world is you have to show. Some people show by what they have rather than who they are, because it can be easier to reach the masses. You can't have a one-on-one conversation with everybody and say, this is who I am. But you can show who you are by what you buy to millions of people without having to explain yourself. Yeah. And that's kind of what it was. So money really allowed me to show off to other people that, you know what, I am successful. Yeah, because I could buy new jackets, new toys. I could stay in a $2,000 a night hotel. I could do a lot of cool things. And people, but it gets tiring, bro. Because you know what happens? Once I was stripped of all that and I sat naked in a prison cell with a little $1 Chinese yellow jumpsuit, like, you know what I'm doing is, I didn't have the energy anymore to prove myself to all these people that I am successful. It was really just like I was hollow inside, exhausted. I was tired of that rat race. It was really about the simple things, food, shelter, and love, and having high quality food, the best, because you miss that when you're in prison, and a good shelter, good air quality, and then also real love, not the fake love, like the real love, you know, that is what is more important than money. But let's not get it twisted. Money is important to a point, right? Because food is expensive. Yeah. Food is expensive and shelter is expensive. And it's not getting any cheaper.
No, it's not. So you've got all this money, like filled, like stacked of money. You're buying gold, right? You like gold. Gold's good. And everyone that I know loves gold. What was it about gold that was appealing to you? No counterparty risk. You didn't have to worry. You could physically take it and go bury it in the woods like you did. You could go convert pile, like a room full of cash into a brick of gold and then take that and move it somewhere. Was there any interest in Bitcoin? Any interest in crypto? Like, or were you too early for all that stuff?
Yeah, it was too early. I keep in mind, I got arrested in 2009, so I hadn't heard of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think it was just coming out then in like 2010.
Yeah, so gold, well, I used to bury cash when I was real young in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then one time I went and dug up $500,000 in cash after a year, and all the bills were sticking together. It was musty, like it wasn't airtight. And one of my suppliers had told me like a month later, he's like, hey, you can't do that anymore. I guess he couldn't count the money or something because it was all stuck together.
Yeah.
So I started thinking of new ways to bury my my valuables. You know, you can't just have the money sitting around in a house because the feds raid homes based on tips. And I learned that at a young age. Listen, I went through a lot of stuff because I started at the bottom with 20 bags. And I learned in college. In college, I was being watched briefly for a minute. There were a couple kids that wore wires on me. So I understood how the enemy, law enforcement, was working at a very young age, not only by watching Miami Vice as a kid in my mom's bedroom, but also by experience with small little busts as I worked my way up in the through the ranks. But yeah, I bear throw gold anywhere. You can just take a brick of gold and throw it in the ocean and go get it 100 years later, and it's fine. It's still a brick of gold. You might have to brush it off a little, but
yeah.
So that's why I bear gold. And plus, it's a good hedge against inflation, somewhat. At least it used to be. I'm not sure if it is anymore, but
yeah,
maybe Bitcoin's the future. I have no clue.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, man, you gotta, if we could, give some gold advice from sell weed, convert it into dollar bills and convert it into gold. I'll tell you, it was, but what else could you spend it on? Right. You're trying to stay under the radar. So you've got all this money, you convert a bunch of it to gold and hide it. Great idea. But now you've still got more money. There's only so many $2,000 a night rooms you can get and escorts and everything. Like you bought the truck, you know, but again, you can't buy the flashy stuff. You can afford it. You could more than afford it, but you couldn't physically buy it. Was there any time that you just wanted, to break character, go on a bender, go somewhere and like party it out and then maybe come back to your life? Or was that just all too fucking risky?
I did that. I spent a couple million dollars traveling around interviewing women.
Oh, that's right. That's right. The movie.
Is that me?
Yeah. No, it might be me. It's me. Okay. I'm sorry. I think it was on my end.
All right, no problem.
You went to LA and did the movie and everything. Was that money laundering, or was that a real investment? Were you trying to wash money? Were you trying to build a parallel career, something that you could maybe ditch the weed sales and pivot into this at some point, like more legitimate, like whatever legitimate Hollywood is? Was that the plan?
Well, the plan is, as I said in the book, it was true. Everything in the book's true to a T. Girlfriend breaks up with me when I'm 24, 25, 26, maybe somewhere around then. And I was heartbroken. So I knew a lot of people. No, I shouldn't say I knew. I knew a few people in the film industry. So I decided to create a little docu-series, web series of some sorts. In my mind, I'd travel around the country and interview women on time, money, and sex, the role it played within their relationship. And I had 36 questions based around these three topics and a small little film crew. So we traveled around. I interviewed 350 women in select cities around the United States, threw big parties. I blew a couple million bucks on this. We rented yachts, Rolls Royces, throw up $50,000 parties with like lavish, just good looking women, full bars, services, rent out chalets, whatever. I blew a lot of money doing that. So I did spend money, but to make money, I was thinking maybe this could turn into a real series. It was kind of like before, it was after Girls Gone Wild that happened, but before Dan Blazarian
gotcha.
Made a name for himself. I was like in between those two guys, but it never became a success because I pulled back a little because I didn't want to be noticed. I was scared, you know, because I was still had the underground dealings that I didn't want to be on the map because I went to Hollywood and I was I remember I was once at Harvey Weinstein's party. He's like, I'd love to see your footage. This is back in 2006 or seven. And
oh, I bet he would.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to talk about that. I don't even know the guy, but I met him once there and I was like, it might've been my chance to get something, make something happen, but I didn't follow through with it because of, I wasn't ready to be in the spotlight. I needed to close down my operation or sell it to somebody.
Yeah. Well, we're just talking here, right? But just what are some ways that people can wash money? Like what's like if you're
people
somebody
do it all the time, all the time, bro. I mean, where do we start? You can be small time and have a pizza shop. It's a cash business. If you only sell 3,000 in pizza, you can put in 10,000 in the register and say you sold 10,000 in pizza that day. That's you can do that in restaurant business, any cash business, laundromat, anything that you can think of as cash. And then there's bigger businesses like people that are building. Think about in the 80s and 90s, how Miami was built, all those skyscrapers down in Brickell and stuff, the city of cocaine, man, like billions of dollars. Not that I witnessed it, but we have all heard the rumors, which are probably true, that, you know, you can pay all your subcontractors to build these buildings in cash. There's no reason. If it costs, you know, $20 million in concrete, you could pay $10 million in cash and $10 million in check. You know, that's how you launder the money. There's a lot of different ways. And keep in mind, I wasn't at the top of the drug game. I was in cartel. Like, I was a level 9 in the game. 10 is when you take out the witnesses. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have went that level, but I didn't. That was just not in me. Like that first time I got arrested, I could have got rid of the witness. And then they would have known who I was. Then I would have had to go deeper undercover. I would have had to put a stronger wall around me, hire more lieutenants. Like, it would be a whole different level. Like, I had my run and I stopped right where I wanted to stop. And also, once you get into those higher levels of dealing with narcotics, you know, higher margins, 5, 6, 7, 8% margin. I do $1 million deal, make 60 grand. It's not a huge, you know, you do $1 million coke deal, you're going to make $1 million bucks. You know, maybe make $500,000. That's big money.
Wow.
So for me, I did a lot of volume consistently day after day with small margins.
Were you ever tempted to get into coke?
No, just penalties are too high. It was a calculated risk when I went into cannabis. I went in knowing that I had no prior offenses, I had no children to provide for, and that I could afford to get pinched once with cannabis, which is, I figured every judge in America has at least seen a joint smoked. So I was like, you know, maybe they'll be light on me. It's calculated risk. Keep in mind, as a child, I was ready to jump. I was in a position where I didn't think I was going to make it. And that's what really catapulted me into the cannabis game, because I didn't have enough money to go home to face what I would be facing. So for me, the calculated risk was to sell weed. And I started in 10th grade and did it right up till age 30.
Wow. This might sound like a crazy thing, but like as a business, like, do you ever get hired as a consultant? Because like, you clearly understood like margins, supply chain, and things like that. Like, I would see you as pretty valuable, like as a corporation, like somebody that could come in and help make everything kind of run a little bit better. Like, do you get offers to do that?
I haven't really put myself out, man. Like, writing this book was I wrote the whole thing myself, and it was very humbling experience. I was off grid. I was renting cabins in remote places, and I'm just getting back out into the world. So I'm trying to figure out exactly what I'm going to do. I want to do something that can scale and that I'll enjoy, but that also won't rob me of my life, right? Because I was making a ton of money, but I was robbed of my free time. I didn't find the sweet thing called balance. Yeah. So a lot of us work to that little faint dream or vision we have of retirement. And then once you get to retirement, it's really not what you thought it would be. You're older. You can't really enjoy your money the way you could when you were 20, 30. So I'm trying to figure out exactly what industry I'll get into that can scale, but not also rob me of my free time. Because I'm not looking forward to retirement. I'm looking forward to just enjoying a little bit of every day and working hard a little bit every day and just finding balance in every day. Like, tomorrow may not come. Because to me, tomorrow may not come. I've had, you know, jail, prison. I've been airlifted to the ICU twice. Once I caught on fire, another time collapsed lung, broke ribs. Like, I've had a lot of crazy accidents in my life. I've seen the white light and said, can I just have a little more time? And time really is more money. So once again, it comes back to balance. Time, money, how can you have it all? Not be too greedy. I was probably greedy at times too. Probably, like, you know, I sometimes wouldn't get off my couch unless I could make 40 grand. You know, I would be like, they would call, hey, I need an order. And I had it in inventory, but I just wouldn't want to get up that moment and do the deal, which is crazy. But to me, at least. Yeah.
Well, what did your relation? So through this book, there's an investigator named Ron who's after you. And I got the feeling that in the moment, you didn't like Ron. But after it was all said and done, I think you, it seemed like you guys maybe had, there was like a mutual respect for one another. His job is to catch you. You know, your job is to get away. You both did a pretty good job of doing both of those things. You kind of ended in a, almost like a tie. I mean, I guess he caught you in the end. You did a little bit of time, but not what, not what you could have done, and not what, and you wouldn't take the easy out that they were offering you. And I think it seemed like it, it felt like he was frustrated with you, but at the same time, maybe a little bit respected you. Is that how that relationship ended up after all?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a tough opponent. It was the biggest battle of my life. He was on me like white on rice. He knew what I ate for breakfast and what type of laundry detergent I used. I'm sure there were trackers on my cars, bugs in the houses. He was really, spent a lot of money. I read somewhere I spent like $1.4 million investigating me for, it was only, it wasn't even that long of a time, but that's an expensive procedure to do. Yeah, he was a highly intelligent, and he didn't stop until he wanted my money, and he was very good and he got it. He was a tough opponent, but I didn't have to give up all that money. If I worked for him from day one and just cooperated and told him where I was getting product, where it was going, and gave him the ins and outs of my organization, I could have saved myself 10, 12 million bucks. But ethically, I took the long, hard way out, and I paid the money, and I paid a lot of money to me, and I did some time. I did close to 2 years. And, but it was a good lesson. It's a good lesson, but you know, don't get me wrong. Sometimes I think, man, I gave him way too much, but that's in the book. You have to really figure out the strategy on how I negotiated that deal. It was cat and mouse game that I played with him. And he was a very intelligent investigator, and he was good at what he did.
But you were good at what you did too. Because there were a couple times when I'm reading it, I was thinking, oh, he's giving him everything. He's going to give him everything. And you didn't. And he had, then there was like another thing. And that, you know, and so it's like you had a pretty good strategy too. You got to the point where, and this is what I said when I mentioned the Chipotle story, where you guys are out there digging up all this gold, and you're telling, you would have spent a million. You're out there, out of prison, right? In shackled in your jumpsuit, telling him where to dig. And you're saying you would have spent $1 million for Chipotle for lunch. I'll never look at Chipotle the same way again, man. After that, yeah, well, I just thought that flavor was so funny.
You can't get that flavor in a jail cell.
No.
The food is very bland. It's very bland. And that was the toughest part. I didn't mind the alone time being in a cell. It was just the food. That was the problem. It's lacks nutrients. It's not a healthy way to reform criminals, if that's what they're trying to do.
No. What was your position inside jail, prison? Because you were nonviolent, but
yeah, nobody. Where they put me? They put me the first 4 months. They put me with all the violent guys, the murderers, and so, because they were trying to squeeze me to get money out of me. Mm-hmm. And eventually, after I paid the money, I moved to a lower security. Then they actually moved me from jail to eventually after a couple of years. That's in the book, but I was in a prison for about a year in a low, which is almost like a camp type facility, which is easy, bro. It's just the food sucks. Just boring. But yeah, I read books. It was no big deal, but it was still shouldn't even have went for the amount of money I gave them, man. But
yeah. But when you were in jail with the dangerous guys, how did the dangerous guys treat you?
They respect me because they all would love to be that level in the drug game. And then at least the spot I was, none of them have gotten to that level. Like a lot of those guys, that's their dream to see $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they'll kill people for 10 grand, you know, literally take out a, so, yeah, no, I didn't have any problems in jail, thankfully. You know, it was fine, man. It was just, yeah. Listen, evading the law at that age in my 20s was fun. There's nothing like the stress and pressure that comes up to doing $1 million deal in a remote location. You have no clue where you're going to be. You have no clue if it's being watched, if you're going to get pinched that night. And then you make it home that night with $1 million in cash and you just throw it in the closet. And then you take 10 grand out and call a girl up to come over. Like that right there is that right 20s. There.
That's pretty that, tempting. You know,
yeah. I became a millionaire by age 21, 22.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a good understanding of money just because I've made it from nothing, whether you call it legal or illegal. It's a lot harder to make illegal money at that level than it is legally. Like if I had started building apartments or something that age, I'd be probably a billionaire by now. Because in the underworld, not only are you against competition, which cannabis, there's tons of competition because everybody had weed even back then. That's why the margins are so low. But you're also trying to constantly dodge the law and investigations, which are always in rings around you. And you have to have good gut instincts and know how to dodge those bullets. And that's what I was good at. But it's stressful. It's stressful, but it's also, it's nice having endless money. And it was just a nice experience, bro. You know, I learned a lot. I learned a lot. It's nice being able to pay people and give them whatever amount of money you want, pay for people's food and grease the doorman and all that stuff. But it was good. But I have to say, after I got arrested, the last 10 years of my life were way better.
Really?
Way better. Yeah, they were actually better. Like, even though I've lived very simply, it's just I'm a lot healthier, stronger, and I already had a chance to do that. And the problem is when you're at a really high level like that, a lot of people want your attention, and it's draining at times. Mm. When you're making a lot of money, everybody wants something from you, and they'll be nice. They're opportunistic feeders. Not everybody, but they'll tell you nice things for months, hoping then they'll make their strike for what they want.
Mm.
And it's like, this is just time consuming. If I make big money again, I'm not going to tell anybody I'm making it. Even though I wasn't telling people then, I'm just still going to even be more closed up because,
it brings out the worst in people. It seems like a lot of people,
everybody wants to be your friend. I don't even have time for my five friends now. By the time I brush my teeth, do my workout, and day's half over, then you got to work, make some money. It's like, you don't have time for, that's the thing that bothers me about social media is social media many times has been invented by antisocial people. The whole layout, I got arrested and then all of a sudden that's around when Facebook came out. So I'm just sitting at home tinkering around. I'm like, what the hell is this? People like commenting on my wall. I'm like, what the hell is this shit?
Yeah.
Like, do people have anything to do? And I started looking into it because I didn't have a job. I was just sitting around waiting for my trial. And, I just was like, wow, this is crazy world, because I paid people to run my MySpace account. So I never actually used any of the stuff. This is 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I'm going off on this tangent, but let me tell you what's very important. If anybody gets on the social media, is isolating people from real interaction. It's draining you. It's draining you of your self-worth. Who the hell has, you post a picture, think about it, and then you wait for likes, and they actually have a counter on there to show how many likes you get to see if you did good enough. That is called psychologically fucked Looney Tunes shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Training. So the key is you can use it, but you need to be above the people that created it and understand with the logic and the psychology behind it and not let it fuck with you. I'm a confident dude and it fucks with me. Like, what if I post this podcast that we're doing right now and I only gets 2 likes?
Oh,
I'm gonna feel like a loser, bro.
Oh, it's the end of the world.
Yeah, of course. Dude, like, what the hell? I'm really torn with that. I actually invented in my prison cell, but the hardware is not completely ready for it. And I spent a lot of money doing trademarks around the world on it and stuff. We'll see if I revisit that down the road, but I have it all tucked away somewhere. But where am I going with this? Oh, the last 10 years have been good for me because I've been off grid, bro. Not a lot of energy suckers around me. Time to focus on myself, heal and strengthen. And that's where I was going with that. I apologize.
Well, listen, I mean, I talked to, I was at a conference speaking a couple years ago. I met Freeway Rick Ross. Do you know who he is? Freeway Rick?
Yeah.
And I pulled him aside. I said, hey, man, when I was in college in LA, like we heard stories of you that you were counting so much money, you'd worn your fingerprints off of your fingers and that you were making $2 million a day cash. Can you confirm any of that? He's like, well, your story's partially true. Like, okay. He's like, I was making $3 million a day. I was like, oh shit. And he's like, and it wasn't that my fingerprints wore off. It's that when you're counting all this money, it's very dirty. And if you get like a little bit of a paper cut, you get these infections. And he's like, so my fingers were always kind of infected from the money stuff. And so he's like, your story's kind of part true. I was like, oh shit. I was expecting it to be 0% true. Did you ever have any sort of instances where you're like Miami Vice style, where you're sitting around with the money counting machine?
I had a money counter machine, but honestly, the bigger I got in the game, I didn't count money.
Yeah.
So I didn't even weigh it. You just look in the bag and they say, like, you'll look through the bricks. You'll be like, oh, that's a $10,000 brick. That's a $10,000 brick. Actually, we did them all in $5,000 bricks, and I would just count the bricks. So, you know, you get, what do you got? $25,000 bricks is $100,000. 20 times 10. So 200 bricks of cash is $1 million. You know, I would sometimes count the bricks, but sometimes if you're in a big rush, you just know it's $1 million in that bag. And then you hand that over to the next guy. And then it's occasionally you'll hear, oh, it was under, you know, and then it gets fixed. You never hear it was over though.
You know, that's funny.
Actually, a couple people though. No, I shouldn't say that. I should take that. There are a few people I remember specifically their names that would be like, oh, that's $70,000 over. Remember specifically she had said that. I was like, oh, no shit. That was a thoughtful over.
That's funny.
Yeah.
No violence.
It's always in the periphery here and there, but 95% people are there to make money. And you're not going to be making money when there's violence everywhere. You know, like, it's about smooth transactions. Everybody wants to make money. That's actually in the underworld. People get paid more than they do in the legal world. It's not like with lawyers, oh, I'm going to call my lawyer. It's like, no, in the underworld, it's like, you're going to pay me, right? You know, you don't even need to say that. People just know. So I'd have to say there's no violence on my behalf. So that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That gets messy. What about this? What about your relationship with Jim in this book? This is a big, important guy, an important character that runs from the beginning all the way to the very end. This is your stepfather, Jim?
Yes, yeah? Correct.
What an interesting sort of story arc with him. You know, it starts off early on and you guys are, you know, you've got problems at home with your mom and Jim is there and he always seemed to be, you know, he seemed to be like the one guy maybe you could go to if you had the problem. He was like, he was going to not really come down. He wasn't going to freak out on you. How'd that relationship last over, you know, once he in retrospect looked back and realized like, oh shit, for the last 10 years plus, you've been selling hundreds of millions of dollars of marijuana and we didn't know what was going on. Is that relationship still intact with you and Jim?
No, I don't talk to my family anymore, but that's a whole nother story I don't want to get into. That's a whole nother story. We got the family in the beginning of the book. That's the motivating factor part of it. I closed out my family at the end of the book, but the present day, there's no book on the present day right now. And we're not going to talk about that in the interview.
Gotcha.
So I can tell you one thing though, you know, doing business with family costs me a lot of problems. That's one thing, but we all know how that works.
What about loyalty in this business? Because I've always heard there is no loyalty in this business, but you seemed loyal. You seemed like
I was loyal. I was loyal. I paid, like I said, $12 million to not tell on people I'll never see again. And I found out at a later date, one of the people that I was not telling on was one of the guys that actually told on me. And I didn't, you know, there's like, it's a freaking messy situation. Listen, you know, they say crime doesn't pay, crime pays. There's all different theories on that. But, you know, crime pays, but you have to keep your mouth shut and you have to work hard. And I'm not talking about crime. I'm talking about drug dealing. It's just weed. I'm not embarrassed about what I did. I used to smoke weed. I liked weed. I don't smoke anymore. I don't believe I could hurt anybody. But loyalty in that business. Listen, my lawyer told me something. He goes, Eric, don't ever go back. He goes, everybody is a double agent. And it's in a way, it's true. Like, as you get higher in the game, You got guys that are going to rat you out while they're still doing business on the side just so they can get out. And they're everybody's looking out for themselves. As you get higher in the game, that is a very realistic situation. So it's like, you know, the people at the way top that are untouchable, they're connected, you know? You know the right people. But still, it's a messy game, bro. But there isn't loyalty in every... There's so much... It's not just about the street. This is in the real world. There's so much disloyalty, even the legitimate world. So I don't know. People are people, and people are going to do what they want to do, whether it's in the legal industry or illegal industry.
Yeah, it just seemed like you handled your business in a way that was like had to have been refreshing for the people that dealt with you.
Yeah, people loved working with me. They always came back. That's how my empire grew so organically and spiraled into me having an account on every single state on the East Coast, because I showed up on time. I always kept my word, always over delivered, under promised. And basically, I don't bring any weird vibes to the table. I show up, I tell you what I'm going to do, I tell you what I'm going to have, and I execute. Done. None of this like circle jerk talking corny. Like, I can't tell you. Honestly, that's another reason I've been off the grid for so long writing this book, because I'm coming back into the world and I have to start at the bottom. So it wasn't all the money I lost. It was my team. It took me years and years to weed through all the weak links and the people that run their mouths and have something to prove and nothing to show. Now I have to do that. Let's just hypothetically say I want to build apartments. Now I have to go and find out who is the real guy that can pour concrete. Who's going to actually show up at 8 a.m. when he said he's going to show up and get the job done? Who's the guy that's going to give me a reasonable price where I can scale and grow the company and keep calm and all make money together for the next 20 years? Like, I have to find these people, and I might have to weed through 10 concrete guys to get the one that's the G, you know? So... Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at. Like, you know, it wasn't all the money I lost. It was my team. Because if you have a good team in place, you can make money anywhere.
This is why I think you'd be a great consultant. Because people could, the rules or strategies that you used for selling weed, a lot of that you could apply to building apartments. I know. I work in fucking real estate. I mean, I know that we have the same problems. When you find good people, I want you. You're like, that's my loan officer. That's my electrician. That's it. That when we renovate and flip houses as in Vegas as a side project, all the time, we're constantly shuffling through. That guy's a shithead. He'll never show up. That guy got deported last time we were on a job. So forget him. So we had to kind of do that. But again, we've had 10 years of doing that to get good at what we do and build our team. And like you said, you had to restart from the beginning. So that's got to be frustrating. But I guess the good news is, you know what you're looking for. You know them when you see them. You probably have a PhD in dealing with human beings after 10 years of that and a couple years in prison. I mean, my God, your people skills have got to be off the charts from something like this, right?
Right. Yeah, I would say that's correct.
Yeah.
I have a very good understanding of people, and I can see their moves well before they make them. Just based on, I can look at somebody's eyes and really tell their health, their vitality. Are they going to flake out? Are they going to make it? Can they sustain the pressure? What are they going to do when shit hits the fan? Like, I can tell how all these people are going to be. You know, there's proactive people and there's reactive people, and I really like to align with the proactive ones.
For sure. Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up with this. You've been out now for a decade. Any regrets?
No. I guess not. I wouldn't know what I do. Sometimes I toss and turn. I'm like, I wish I didn't get caught, because, you know, I made the money too fast, man. I grinded so hard. There's still guys out there that I know that make money. They didn't get as big as me, and they make their little bit of money every month on the side. They do their thing, and but would I trade my life for theirs? Probably not. Actually, that good news is I wouldn't trade my life for anybody else that I personally know. That's okay. Good news. The only regret is I paid them too much. shouldn't have paid him that much. It's in the story. I paid him three different times. Like I paid him once $5 million in gold, and another time $6 million, and then $4 million, $5 million, $1 million. I can't remember the exact numbers. It totaled up to close to $12 million that I paid him, and how I did that is in the book. But I paid him a little too much, tad bit too much. They got paid, and other than that, no regrets. I guess thankful for what I have, and hopefully more to come.
Dude, I'll tell you what, man. For anyone that wants to get a good book that initially is about weed, at least that's maybe what you think, but I would say it's deeper than that. Here's the book. It's called Pressure by Eric Kanori. Man, I'm going to put a link in the description for people, so if they want to just easily get it from you.
Eric, Charlie, I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate you having me on. Hey, the only part we didn't bring up is, did you like when I outran the Fez at 100 miles an hour on the highway? That's my favorite. You don't remember that part, dude? Are you sure? When they first put eyes on me and they followed the load to my house? Oh, man, we're not going to get into it now.
All right.
That's my favorite part.
We'll do it another time.
All right, man.
We'll do it another time, man. Right, yeah, right. Listen, I've got no love for the Fed. So anybody that can outrun or maneuver them or fuck them over or get out in 2 years after, listen, man, I'm on your side on this one. I mean, the federal government's not going to get any sort of love from me. I think that all these drugs should be decriminalized and let us be adults and figure it out for ourselves. But then again, what do I know? I'm just some shithead that speaks at anarchist conventions. That's Eric Kanori, everybody. If you liked this interview, I'll tell you, you're going to love the book. I'm going to put the links in the show notes. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at macroaggressions. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.